Thank you for joining us. I'm here with Catherine Judd, clinical professor, physician assistant at UT Southwestern and Parkland Health and Hospital Center, as well as being an expert on medical education related to pain, addiction, and in a variety of settings, academic settings, and even prison settings. So where do we start? You've made major contributions to how we think about educating physician assistants and physicians in substance use disorders. What do you think is the most essential of all of the things you've learned about education for prevention and education for identification and early intervention?
Yes. Thank you very much for this opportunity. And yes, you're absolutely right. I've worn a number of hats through my career in terms of as a PA in research, in medical education, as well as clinical practice. And as you said, much of my clinical practice in the last 10 or 12 years has been in correctional care with Parkland Health and Hospital System in the Dallas County Jail. And in that context, in clinical care, of course, treating an incredible number of patients who are now incarcerated in jail facing legal charges around substance use. And as I listen to their stories, what I hear in their stories is how many of them started down this road of substance use and addictive disease as a consequence of being prescribed medication by healthcare providers. It could have been as a result of a surgery, it could have been a result of perhaps an accident, trauma, motor vehicle accident, perhaps an occupational injury, falling off a ladder with a back injury. It could have been post-operatively subsequent to having a surgery for perhaps, a back surgery, fractured leg. It could be almost anything. And in that context, when we talk about medical education, because I also precept students, mm-hmm. PA students, residents within the jail. And one of the most important things that I try and teach them and get a sense of their awareness of is their own behaviors and attitudes towards these patients. Treatment for addictive disease, substance use, we do have medications available now. But key in treatment is that patient healthcare provider relationship. Mm-hmm. That relationship is built on attitudes and behaviors towards those patients. I'm a proponent of motivational interviewing. Mm-hmm. I think that is a skill. Some would say, "Oh, that takes too much time. I don't have time to listen to a patient with empathy. I don't have time to listen to a patient and express reassurance. I don't have time to get a sense of where the patient is in dealing with their disease or in dealing with their substance use." I find that unacceptable. Mm-hmm. That should be inherent in our approach to our patient, that we come to them wanting to understand where they are. How do they frame their situation in terms of their substance use, their medication use? If they identify themselves as having a problem, if they're at that stage, we talk about Prochaska DiClementi's stages of change, mm-hmm. In terms of pre-contemplation, contemplation. Are they at a stage in terms of their substance abuse or in managing their pain or whatever the issues are they have in front of them, ready to change? So I could go on and on about motivational interviewing and the way we approach our patients, but I think key in education is attitudes and behavior. Mm-hmm. To start with, as we approach our treatment of patients.
So for PAs, you have data and understanding about how many of them prescribe opioids and how many of them might be interested in working with people who might have a substance use disorder.
Yes, and thank you for asking about PAs and what their practice is and what their own perceived needs are. I did a survey last year, actually, of PAs, a needs assessment. And what I discovered in that data that we collected is that PAs are prescribing. They're prescribing both Schedule 3 as well as Schedule 2 drugs. They're managing patients with pain. In fact, I think it was nearly 80% of the respondents said they were indeed managing patients with pain in their practices. They're also managing patients who are being prescribed opioids mm-hmm. in their practices. Now, they may not have initiated the original medication. It may have been their supervising physician, but they are indeed doing the follow-up and the managing of patients. And the majority of the PA surveyed expressed a need and a desire for additional education. Additional education around prescribing opioids, additional education information around managing these patients. And it was across multi-disciplines. It was children and adolescents, it was pregnant patients, it was post-op patients, it was the elderly. So it's across the lifespan mm-hmm. that they're expressing their need for education and training around management of patients.
So what do you think about the PA's role in working with underserved populations, working in gaps of care, and just currently and in the future?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. I think, when you look at PA practice and where PAs are practicing, they indeed are filling a gap in underserved populations. In terms of psychiatry, for example, in mental health, mm-hmm. it's in the community mental health centers. Mm-hmm. Also in urban areas and serving populations where access to care mm-hmm. may be an issue.
Yeah, one of my friends and colleagues, a former mentee, works at Yale, and he said, if you look at SUD treatments, just looking at opioid use, and you might say, well, gee, they should use a lot of methadone in homeless population, but in fact, they can't come to clinic every day. Mm-hmm. So they'll actually use more Vivitrol in that population because they only have to see the person once a month.
Sure, yeah.
So it's really, when you haven't worked in a underserved or populations with no medical service, you often can't think through what the problems might be. But pain must be a terrible problem to evaluate and treat, given all the restrictions.
Yeah, it does present its challenges. And the access to care for unserved, underserved populations, and it may be, as you pointed out just now, it could be transportation. Mm-hmm. Follow-up can frequently be a challenge for patients, and patients, depending on what their pain issue is and what their disability is, it may be more than just the bus ticket mm-hmm. getting there. It may be getting on and off the bus. Mm-hmm. May be an issue in terms of access to care. Access to care could also be a third-party payer issue. Mm-hmm. When we look at some of the treatment modalities we have available to us for chronic pain, they're not all pharmacologic. And third-party payers frequently are not willing to pay for acupuncture. They're not willing to pay for massage. There may be limitations on PT, for example. And I think when we look at chronic pain, we need to also consider, in terms of our treatment modalities, alternatives to pharmacologic treatments.
I agree. We just had Dr. Ovesen in here who said that their pain program was gender responsive, but also had physical therapy and prescriptive exercise. Mm-hmm. I mean, that Wouldn't that be great?
Sure. And I think also part of treating chronic pain needs to include the whole idea and a model for wellness. Mm-hmm. And when we think of wellness, wellness encompasses a number of areas, particularly when it comes to pain, that includes sleep, exercise, diet, social interaction, for example, and that our treatment can also include a wellness component. And there are wellness programs that are out there and accessible with apps and on the internet. Mm-hmm. That again, I think if we, when we talk about education and skill set, improving skills for our healthcare providers, it may be including information about some of these apps, how to use them, how to implement them in our practices. And some of these non-pharmacologic mm-hmm. modalities mean helping, engaging patients. You know, one of the things that I think we need to keep in mind is that patients, we need to listen to patients in terms of their stories, where they're coming from, how they frame their pain, how they deal with their pain, what approaches to treatment would work for them. And patients know that. Mm-hmm. We just need to listen and perhaps be less paternalistic in the way we treat patients and our approach to patients.
In your practice and career, you've seen great progress in how we've understood cigarette smoking, and when you talk about stages of change and mm-hmm. motivational interviewing, that's been applied nicely to cigarette smoking. Probably that, I think that was the first proof of principle.
Sure.
But somehow we're not progressing in the same way in opioid use disorder. 50,000 people may die this year in the United States mm-hmm. alone, and we might have 2 million people with opioid dependence, opioid use disorder right now. What do you think we can do?
Well, you mentioned the smoking campaign a number of years ago. And that model, I think we were very successful in the application of that model. And I think that same model could be applied to opiate use and substance use disorders. I can give you, I can tell you about an encounter I had with a young juvenile who was in detention. And I was doing his intake, and I was asking him, about his history and family history, medical history. He had asthma, which was one of the reasons why he came to the medicine clinic. And then I was asking about his substance use. He was smoking marijuana. A lot.
Is that indicated for asthma?
No, it's not as indicated for asthma, but he was smoking marijuana. He was dabbling in inhalants, huffing, had tried some benzos, pills, wasn't into powders or needles. He didn't like needles yet. And then I wound up by asking him about smoking, and he looked at me horrified. And he said, smoking? Cigarettes? Those will kill you.
So there's a both an opioid use disorder epidemic, an opioid overdose epidemic, and at the same time, it seems that our life expectancy is going down with the addition of a suicide epidemic. Can you make any sense of that for us?
I think there's an intersection of both the opioid epidemic, overdose with lethal outcomes, and suicide. I think one of the questions that needs to be asked of the suicide data is how many of those overdoses with lethal outcomes may have been veiled mm-hmm. suicide attempts, particularly in pain patients. Mm-hmm. When we're looking at suicide, one of the things that we're looking at in terms of intervention is something called means restriction. What does means restriction mean? What means restrictions means is limiting a patient's access to the means, which is usually going to be weapons, mm-hmm. could be hanging, limiting their access to a means of ending their lives. That same model could very well be applied to opioid use, the potential for a lethal outcome mm-hmm. in the use of opioids. So what does that mean? That means limiting access to opioids, those medications that taken in excessive quantities could lead to a lethal outcome. But I think in terms of opioids, there's a little bit, there's another piece, and that other piece is rescue. Mm-hmm. That there needs to be available a rescue from that potential lethal outcome.
Narcan.
Absolutely, Narcan. And that is the rescue. The means restriction in terms of how much we're prescribing, how much patients have access to. If we're not able to restrict the means, then we need to make accessible a rescue. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. On the Stanford study of the single most important thing that could be done to help with the opioid death and addiction epidemic, it would start with naloxone.
Mm-hmm. And so if we look around, if we look in airports, we look in churches, we look in schools, we look in supermarkets and shopping centers, we see AEDs.
Mm-hmm.
We have AEDs everywhere now mm-hmm. because we've recognized the importance of resuscitation. We've recognized the importance of CPR. We've mm-hmm. recognized the importance of defibrillation. What about having Narcan
right.
in every AED compartment? And
it's true. It's in. There's a recent paper on the lack of naloxone on airplanes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think that model of thinking that you just presented, thinking about naloxone reversal of an overdose as first aid,
mm-hmm.
like a Heimlich maneuver or like CPR.
Exactly.
Is the public health model that we should embrace.
Yeah. And how much time does it take to teach a responder how to do the Heimlich maneuver? How much time does it take to teach CPR?
Mm-hmm.
How much time would it take to teach injecting Narcan?
Especially now that it's intranasal.
Exactly.
So that you don't even have a needle barrier or finding a vein or even in the old days we used to have pop open the vials and mm-hmm. draw them up. And
yeah.
I remember cutting my fingers. And
right.
I agree with you. And it also leads to the next point, which would be if it's like cardioversion,
mm-hmm.
then the next step should be evaluation and treatment and not just sending the person home.
Correct. We need to have a seamless system for continuity of care
mm-hmm.
where rescue leads to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to lead to treatment. And that may mean, in terms of that continuity of care, long-term care, lifelong care. And so consequently, the patients that I take care of who in outpatient treatment are working a program for themselves, that this is lifelong care, and that recognizing when they may be at risk and that we have a seamless system of care and treatment and support for those individuals. And that we, in that context, start looking at substance abuse treatment, substance use disorder, opioid use disorder treatment, similar to what we've seen in diabetes. I think in terms of disease states, again, if we're looking at models for treatment and success, we could look to diabetes in terms of diabetes education, patient education, provider education, because this too is a lifelong disease, and applying a model similar to that.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.